This is a tough one to talk about because, you know, we've just entered what I think to be an incredibly kind of complex and nuanced topic. And it's difficult unless somebody themselves has either run a company or likely been in a seat to understand what I'm about to say. And I understand that it's cop-out to say. So here, I'm going to try. But there's a couple of things.
Welcome to Developing Leadership, the podcast for engineering leaders where Iso Kent and Jason Werner share their lessons on the ins and outs of managing software teams. On today's episode, Jason and Iso deep dive into corporate politics, hierarchies, and the sociopaths that often sit at the top. The guys analyze the behaviors of famous C-level leaders, such as Microsoft's Steve Ballmer, and pick apart what engineering leaders can learn from them as they discuss the nuances and complexities of leadership at small and large companies. As always, this episode comes with accompanying show notes, with a deep dive into the main topics, mental models, and key moments from the episode. Find them at developingleadership.co and linked in the episode description. Introducing Athenian's Engineering Insights series, where we invite experienced engineering leaders to share their lessons, challenges, and advice with our community. Join us on Thursday, February 9th, 4 p.m. Central European Time, for a chat on how you can help your teams deliver quality at high speed as we navigate the economic downturn. Link in the description. Developing
Leadership. Hi, everyone. Welcome back again to yet another episode of Developing Leadership. You're catching with us, Jason and I, on a Sunday. Jason, how are you feeling?
Pretty good. It's early, but I'm ready. Got my water.
That sounds good. So right before we start recording this episode, you threw something out at me called the Gervais Principle, and I haven't had a proper time to Google it yet. So can you maybe explain it for me as well?
Let's see if I can actually explain it. But this comes from the TV show, The Office, and the original author, I think, put it in the context of The American Office, because The American Office had multiple seasons and they kind of play it out. But at its root, it's talking about who ends up running companies. And if you Google it, and I'm sure we'll put it in the podcast episode, they have a little bit of a principle here at the very beginning, which says basically company hierarchies end up with three different groups, meta groups of people inside of it. And at the very, very top are sociopaths. And right below them are the clueless. And below the clueless are the losers. And they take great pains to explain that losers are not like losers in life or whatever, but they mean like corporate losers. They're the ones who kind of like lose out on the race of, you know, running companies and stuff like that. And the clueless are important because what the clueless are, they're actually the ones who are the enablers of the sociopaths, as you know, you would imagine. And while it's really funny, it's also not funny if you've really worked in large organizations for some period of time. And there's definitely something funny about it that strikes to the root of probably something to it.
So it's interesting to me because I guess for the sake of this discussion and probably for really digging into this principle, when do we consider an organization large? Is this when we go past Dunbar's number? Is it when we go past the moment where like there's this moment of like we start feeling corporate, right? And I can imagine we're talking sociopaths at the top, we talk politics. I mean, where's the threshold or where's the cutoff? Like, and of course, you know, it's not a one size fits all.
Yeah, it's not one size fits all. It's like it's a really good question. I would assume that there's a lot of different ways you can answer this question, but for me, like, probably how I would consider it is when the corporation itself becomes very attractive to people who might be at the very, very top, like those sociopathic ones, to join. And that could be a small company for what it's worth. Because you can have somebody who's going to join as like president or COO or right hand to a young CEO or something like that, who looks at this as like a perfect opportunity to manipulate and all that sort of stuff. So I think it can actually be a smaller company. Now, I think obviously like the larger the company gets, the more attractive it becomes to sociopathic type of tendencies and in this Gervais principle sort of way. But it doesn't necessarily have to be 10,000 people. It could be a few as a couple of tens of people, maybe a couple dozen.
So if we think about, right, the kind of definition of a sociopath, right, ignoring the feelings of others, you know, the disregard for right and wrong, do we see sociopaths more at larger organizations because it's about capturing value instead of creating value?
So obviously we're going to assume that this Gervais principle thing here is true for like the next little bit. And we're going to say, hey, exactly, this, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And people listening to this, like, yeah, you know, it's funny. Let's just talk about this, right? Let's talk about the largest of the large corporations for a second. And, you know, my experiences with Salesforce and Microsoft, and obviously from that side of the fence, but also GitHub was several thousand people when I left. You know, I think there's a couple of things at play when it comes to like you know, what we might call classically sociopathic folks in leadership positions. One is likely that there's insulation to a degree. Like you can be exposed out to maybe a broader organization, corporation, but failure is not necessarily exclusively on them type of thing. The corporation, the machine is moving, all that sort of stuff. So there's some plausible deniability at play. The other is, this is a trend I've seen over the last, let's say 15 years, but really in the last seven, you see the people with C titles at large organizations have multiple staffs of people that don't actually go and build most things, but it's almost like they're support structures for that person itself. So in that right there is usually a telltale sign to me that something's going on, because, you know, and I'm not talking like admin or chief of staff. I'm talking like, hey, an admin, a business, a PR, like specifically for that person, not even like the office or the group or the division. But, and, you know, I think that that's attractive, one, but also two, it's another insulating factor. You know, there's probably a bunch of different ways in which we can kind of like deconstruct this principle and start seeing signal of it, you know, kind of like retrofit a principle to real life.
Yeah. Can I take a tangent here? Because, and for those of you listening, right, tangents are kind of our thing. You mentioned building the support structure around an individual, right? And I think coming out of a decade of excess capital, from startups to scale-ups to large businesses, we've progressively built more and more structures around the individuals who have like one particular strength. How do you think about this, right? How do you think about the exec who is incredibly, you know, incredibly great and inspiring the team, but, you know, lacks terribly on other fronts that then we decide to start like supplementing, right? Not just the sociopaths, but everyone else. And is it something that, you know, should we be pushing our leadership more instead of kind of, you know, handing them the silver bullet to get away with their faults?
This is a tough one to talk about because, you know, we've just entered what I think to be an incredibly kind of complex and nuanced topic. And it's difficult unless somebody themselves has either run a company or likely been in a seat to understand what I'm about to say. And I understand that it's cop-out to say. So here, I'm going to try. But there's a couple of things. I think that one is, as an organization gets incredibly large, you need generalists and specialists. But the problem is that you don't know exactly what you need in some situations, and you reward behaviors of generalists when you want a specialist, or a specialist when you wanted a generalist, and et cetera, et cetera. And also, a lot of folks very specifically have a strength with a lot of weaknesses. So I'm gonna pick on somebody who I've picked on the podcast before, and this goes to, it's an example, but it goes to kind of the point, which is Steve Ballmer. Steve Ballmer obviously will go down as the worst CEO in Microsoft history between the three people that have been the Microsoft CEO. And it's not even close, right? It's one of those things where Satya has set himself so far and away above Steve Ballmer that he's in Gates-ish territory for his run. Steve Ballmer, by all accounts, is an excellent, excellent salesperson. Excellent. Like, he ran an amazing sales org. He built single-handedly, well, you know what I mean by single-handedly. He was the person responsible for building Microsoft sales in the early days. And if you ask Microsoft era folks from the Steve Ballmer time frame, he's actually quite loved by many, particularly like the more achievement outcome oriented folks. They just love the way that he invigorated people. He inspired people, that famous developer. He had no qualms about standing up on stage and becoming that person who just did all the stupid stuff. But it, you know, at the time, people rallied up, and 25 years later or 30 years later, whatever the time frame is, it looks stupid, but it didn't matter. It got Microsoft to where it is and all that sort of stuff. But he's almost like a singularly or maybe doubly excellent person, which is the sales and the energizing. As a CEO, he was horrendous. Just like absolutely horrendous. He was not strategic. And in fact, like, his decision-making was poor. And there's a lot of factors that could go into this. But if you look at him in those two things, what do we learn from Steve Ballmer? Like, what is the whole totality here? And I like to pick on him as Steve Ballmer, the CEO, but I don't talk about Steve Ballmer, the VP of sales, enough, because he was amazing. He really, really, really was. But he should never have been the CEO. They should never have made him the CEO. In fact, making him the CEO almost killed the company. So there's a lot to deconstruct here and talk about Steve Ballmer and learn from this one. And we could do the same thing with Elon. We could do the same thing with Steve Jobs. We can do the same thing with a bunch of other people. But it's kind of a good interesting use case. My one takeaway from the Steve Ballmer thing is it's more complex, obviously, in situational contexts than we really want to admit. And we like to make things like, you know, 240 characters for Twitter and all that sort of stuff. But in reality, it's never going to be that. That said, you know, it's easy to see why Steve Ballmer, in retrospect, should never have been CEO. So what do we learn from those situations?
If we apply that to engineering leadership for a second, and we look back in the topic of the sociopaths at top, do you feel that the engineering exec, the CTO, and the VP of engineering is less likely to rise to the top as a sociopath as, for instance, a sales leader or the CEO? I personally do think so. Yeah.
Why? Yeah. And as soon as it passes a certain org size, it seems that the skill set needed to achieve a certain set of things no longer becomes about the technical acumen or the ability to inspire engineers. It becomes a Machiavellian political thing. And I don't mean Machiavellian in the bad way. I just mean like, no, I know how to manipulate the systems and I know who to go talk to do the certain things. And you see this all the time when I still get, like as I mentioned before, I get every call for every CTO or, you know, SVP or EVP of engineering in the Valley. And, you know, one of the very important bits of that is like who you end up reporting to in any of those constructs. And each time that happens, you ask like, okay, so is this an engineering org, product org, or all that sort of stuff? And one of the things that pops up in that is this is an engineering org and you're always reporting to somebody whose main skill set is non-engineering. And to me, that is the telltale sign. Like the organization is, they consider this engineering. You're in some side of engineering org, but the person who's running it is not an engineering.
If I think about, if we go back to the smaller organizations for a second, right, and I imagine, I think that from our listeners, they more likely find themselves as an engineering leader at a 1,000 person, 500, 200 person organization than as the CTO of Google. Although, yep. if you're listening, do reach out to us. We'd love to have you on the podcast. There seems to be this notion that that engineering leaders are also held back by the fact that they don't see their team as strategic resources as much as a sales leader might do or the CEO, right? Do you see what I mean? Are there good things from the sociopathic tendencies to kind of play it a bit devil's advocate here that we can pull in and should actually be kind of hoping that engineering leaders can aspire to, high empathy and kindness and all of those things.
Oh, 100% think that there should be things that we can learn from this because everything is a learning opportunity to understand why it might be perceived to be a certain way. It's pretty clear to me, even at small organizations, that if you think about the possibility of sociopaths entering early, they're never going to enter through engineering. There's just a base level competence that you need to have that typically I would assume that they don't possess in that way. I would say that they enter.
I'm going to pause you there. That's a pretty big statement, right? A basic level of competence that I assume sociopaths wouldn't have. Why do you think so? Why can't the sociopath be the most incredible architect or engineer?
Oh, I think they could. For whatever reason, though, I don't think that tends to be the way it works out. Maybe this is an experiential thing as well, given that I feel like I've run across a bunch in my own career and they've never been in the engineering ranks. They have been in legal. They have been in sales. They have been in ops. They have been in... finance is interesting. I don't think I've ever run across one who ended up being the CFO.
It brings me a little more to my point earlier of like the capturing value, just playing a zero-sum game or creating it. I feel that there's, and again, this is really unexplored territory for me.
Yeah.
But then that's also the fun of it, to get explored together. Like, I feel that there's something about someone being a builder and a creator of going from nothing to something that minimizes the likelihood or statistically
the capture
less
versus
likely.
Create value might be an interesting way to frame it. Cause now I'm playing back through, the list of names that I would have in my own head and almost all of them were not creators in their own right in terms of like, even inside their organizations, they were not creators, but what they were the ones who would almost like, I'll take that bit, I'll take that bit, I'll take that bit and kind of do this. Or while this is happening over there, I'll have this. And it kind of like dotted lines around this sort of way. You know, when you're in it and you see it, it feels different, obviously. And then when you post hoc, understand what might have been happening there. You're right. There is something about value capture versus create.
And this brings me to a topic where I know you have a lot of knowledge, and I'm definitely out of my depth. Within engineering, it seems that we come across more people who find themselves on the spectrum, right? And kind of in popular, kind of, you know, you go back 10, 15 years ago, a lot of popular media is to blame. You know, people would throw out things like all lack of empathy and similar words that you would throw out about someone who you would say is a sociopath. Of course, completely disconnected, completely different things. The reason I'm throwing this in is that we might find that we have engineering leaders who are looking at the board with maybe less empathy for the user and more strategic as puzzle pieces. But we wouldn't put in the sociopath bucket that we're talking about, right? So it's not just about looking at it as a resource system optimizing. There's something inherently evil about when we say something's a sociopath. Do you see what I mean?
One of the things I'll say is that there's this tendency to say, let's take the most technical person in any engineering group and make them the head of XYZ.
Yeah.
And that's a very common thing. And the reason why that's said is so much is because it actually is useful in so many different contexts, particularly when it's a very small organization. And when you're a sub 5-person engineering team, yeah, you basically have the job is a tech lead job. When you're a sub 10 or 15 person organization, it's still kind of a tech lead job, just over maybe 2 units. And it's actually the appropriate thing. But obviously that advice does not scale and typically does not work because that individual might not really like the job of what it means to do that when it scales. But it actually is useful in the earlier days and in very specific situations. And so let's take some of the tendencies of what we can classically might consider sociopath, as you mentioned. Yes, there are times where the job actually does look similar to that. And let me describe one very specific time. It's when you're the EVP of engineering or the CTO and you have multiple VPs reporting to you, your job is that job. Like it does look a little bit more like what we talk about. I don't want to say lack of empathy because I think that there's a baseline empathy that everyone should have in their organization. But there's also the counter to that, like an over orientation to empathy that's not the job. That job belongs to those VPs and more importantly, the directors below them even. Your job as the EVP with multiple VPs reporting to you is inspire, strategic, resource allocation, alignment, you know, organizational constructs, efficiencies, like all of that sort of stuff. The inspiration aspect of things might be one that we might classically put into the empathy in terms of like, hey, can people understand you? Can you understand them and all that sort of stuff? But we've mentioned this before on the podcast. If you're an executive, I tell people you should operate in two different modes. You should operate in that psychologist mode or the sociologist mode. And the psychologist mode is when you're sitting across from somebody in a one-on-one or whatever, and you're talking individually about them or career or whatever, et cetera, the work that they're doing. But the sociologist mode is for the good of the company. And if you're an executive, like the vast majority of your time should be in sociologist mode. And I think this is where engineering leaders who kind of grow up through the ranks to engineer, to tech lead, to manager, to director, they can lose forest from trees sometimes. That said, you know, understanding the difference between the two and what it means.
It's interesting because it builds almost a mental model for me that, you know, like you want every leader in your organization to have and be capable of an incredible amount of empathy. But as you are lower in the organization, the percentage of your time, let's put empathy with the, you know, the psychologist mode, right? The percentage of your time and effort that needs to go to psychologist mode is just significantly higher than when you're higher up the org. So we're not saying, you know, as you go further up the org, you should dial down your empathy. What we're saying is as you go further up the org, you need to spend more time as a sociologist. And as a sociologist, you're not optimizing for
an individual.
The best for the individual. You're optimizing the best for the group and for the complex system as a whole, right? Like you're essentially trying to find the global
My analogy here is at some point you're optimizing for the ant colony collapse. Like you're trying to keep the entire ant colony alive. And it's not never about one individual, you know, or group, one individual ant or whatever, or even group of ants inside that. And now there's a lot of people listening to this podcast, what I'm sure are just having this visceral reaction to this. And my reaction to that is, no, like, you have to understand what the job is. If there's 10,000 people in an organ, in a company, and, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 engineers inside that organization, I always encourage the CTO and all executives to say that you have 10,000 people's mortgages and rent and livelihoods at stake, and you have to understand what you're doing, and you're responsible for their ability to pay rent and, you know, make their mortgage payments and all that sort of stuff. And this, you know, we just had all these mass rounds of layoffs and stuff like this. And now there's a lot of to be said inside that itself. But when you're thinking about the long term of all these, this is meta level, this is census level. You have to understand what's at play. Most people, particularly earlier in their career or if they're further down the stack in the corporate hierarchy, cannot break out of themselves in the moment in this. They have no ability to understand what the conversation looks like up here. There's a lot of different ways in which that conversation can be really poorly run too. This is the purpose of our podcast, is to show that it's possible to do this up here without also being the person who just doesn't give an F about anything inside the corporate hierarchy.
No, absolutely. And I think, you know, what I like about the episodes that you and I do together is that it's our way of also exploring ideas that some of which might be bad, right? I think we're kind of, you know, trying to get through it, but always from the point of view of, like, you know, how do you maximize kindheartedness and high performance? As you were talking, it brought me to another thought, like usual. Over the last decade, we've had so many good times. And so the consequence of our decisions as an engineering leader, and I mean consequences of firing people, explicitly firing people, have not been that high if you look at it from the lives of the people you're letting go, right? I let go 50 people. I know a job is waiting for them tomorrow. It's very, very different than if you're an executive in the coal mining industry and for, you know, two decades long, you're letting people go for whom you know it's extremely unlikely they're, you know, going to easily find their next job the next day. Tech is probably going to stay independent of, you know, the craziness, the recessions, everything. You know, demand for tech likely is going to stay for quite some time, that we don't have those same consequences. I don't really know what that means, but it does mean that probably the sociologist or the sociopath doing resource allocation should be allowed to be a little bit more optimizing for the ant colony as a whole, because there's less societal impact. I don't know. You see kind of where I'm going?
We could probably do an entire podcast episode on this, on basically like the good times and some of the things that cause, you know, that caused, I think, knock-on effects. But I will say this. I believe that we are living in a generation of, yes, senior leaders too, but particularly middle managers who have never actually had to make a decision of consequence. And that, to me, is actually one of the root problems, which is the incentive structures allow them to build or to continue to hire people, not have to be, you know, really kind of truthful with themselves and the organization about letting people go. Sometimes even organizations wanted to keep people on so they wouldn't find new homes, so they wouldn't go to a competitor. And yes, like you had all these non-competes and stuff like that, but, you know, a lot of times people just still went to other places. Or, you know, it's better for people to keep a six in place because they could use that in some way. But at the end of the day, too, they were rewarded by having more headcount and they weren't rewarded by outcomes. And there's a lot of, like, what we might call zero interest rate phenomenon out there, and a lot of people have been rewarded for many years in this. And this, to me, is similar, like going back to sports, but this is similar to, like, hey, if you grew up as the literal best athlete, you know, from age 5 to whatever, there's a lot of things you never had to learn. You could just out muscle, out jump, or out whatever somebody, but you may not have to learn some fundamentals, going back to a lot of the things we talked about in the past. And when you get hit in the face with, you know, somebody who's equally talented but has worked harder or learned more or whatever, you get outplayed every time. Yeah. And, you know, I think we're in an environment now where we're starting to see who's getting outplayed and who is playing a different game a long time ago. I absolutely do believe, by the way, that because the scoreboard is money in Silicon Valley or title achievement, that we have listened to the wrong people or a set of wrong people for a 15-year period and will continue to, because in that period they made money or had some achievement.
So in this new environment, do the sociopaths win or do they lose relative to
I don't actually think sociopaths tend to lose. I think sociopaths tend to win. And the reason why they win is because they're willing to do things that somebody else might not be willing to do. Plain and simple.
This brings me to this concept. I'd probably have to source it, but there's this quote that, you know, bad money drives out good money. Gresham's Law. In Gresham's Law, it always comes to this notion of the moment, and you can apply this to lots of different things, but the moment, if you apply it to life and to this concept, the bad drive out the good, I think holds true.
I do
and
too.
So if we look at that with the sociopaths, the top of large companies, the bad drive out the good, but the good still go somewhere. And it's interesting because the good, in my opinion, they go to the smaller organizations. And so we have this kind of, you know, and if we the concept of engineering work, we have this, you know, this kind of, you know, factory line of, you know, the organizations grow, the bad push out the good go back and they create, you know, new great things and the bad take over. There's probably, you know, just like the quote of, you know, bad times make strong men make good times make weak men. I'm sure there's something here as in like, you know, good leaders make great businesses, bad leaders take over and create bad businesses. Except the difference is it doesn't create bad businesses, they actually succeed.
So this is the phenomenon to me, because we talk about, like, again, Microsoft and Salesforce. Microsoft and Salesforce have two of the best sales organizations in the business. They have massive war chests. They're able to survive. If Microsoft could survive and become what it is today with Satya from the Steve Ballmer era, when it's, you know, stock was in the tank and all that sort of stuff, like, you understand why that war chest and how big something is and just what, you know, assets will matter and stuff. And so slight tweak can make a difference. I think that, you know, there's that old saying, which is like, yeah, bad drive out the good and the good end up going to do something interesting somewhere else. I think that what tends to happen is that the, you know, let's say someone's rising through the ranks at one of these places and it's between two people. And for whatever reason, because of the sociopathic tendencies, some person was able to win, quote unquote, win. And then they take over that one role. That person, the other person who loses in that way, goes and leaves and becomes VP of engineering or something over at a startup company, a B stage or something like that, because they want a breath of fresh air. They don't want the corporate politics anymore and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, they do well there. The company has already been doing, maybe the B stage company is doing okay. And they bring it to another level. They do well. They you know, IPO or they exit or something like that. And then at some point, maybe they themselves turn into a version of this. Maybe they're not as bad as the one they saw before, but maybe they're their own version of this. Or maybe what happens is then you bring in other people around them too, that as that company grows from, you know, 500 to 10,000, and then they decide they want to go sit on a beach for 3 years and they become an advisor or something like that in the future. And I think that if you understand like who the excellent, excellent builders are, that is the cycle that you're going to see, is like they grow, then jump, have success, not want to put up with it anymore, leave the game entirely and come back in pockets and do like small little bits of things.
You said something really interesting though that I don't want us to kind of skim over, which is, you know, the good might start actually mimicking some of those tendencies. And I think, and I think we see this a lot, right? Like the true sociopaths is, you'll come across them in larger organizations more, but what I feel we have a lot more of is not the sociopaths, but it's the good mimicking sociopathic behavior.
So I think that there's a couple of things at play here, though the two I would probably point to the most would be, one is probably that they know they have a deficiency, so they're looking how to augment that, and they see a behavior that's getting rewarded, so incentive structures and all that sort of stuff. So they do mimic it in that way. And then we're like, we've talked about this in the past and how we tend to, you know, one, who you spend a predominance of your time, you get your ideas shaped and your view shaped. So let's say that you are a singular entity is surrounded by five sociopaths or something like that, you're going to like start to develop some of these tendencies and that sort of stuff. Yeah. And the other is that I think it's natural over time to understand that you're going to evolve, but you're going to evolve based upon inputs and outputs, and your inputs and outputs are going to change as you get bigger. And because again, like who you're surrounded by or what the organization is doing, you know, it's going to change. And whenever I see this at large organizations, when someone who's been in an organization for 25 years, there's two questions I tend to really try to get to root of here. One is, could they survive in the wild? Do they have actually useful skills? Do they have very specific contextual skills? And then two, are they a survivor? And by that, I mean, are they able to just know how to stay just below the waterline or just above the waterline, but like not make waves and all that sort of stuff? Or are they somebody who is like more on that sociopathic tendency side? And like those are the two I typically see at like the large organizations who have been there for 25 years and like kind of worked their way up and that sort of thing. It's very rare, I think, for somebody to really keep their center and yes, grow, continue to grow, but not fall off one way, not be a mediocre, you know, hey, survivor, and not become an overachiever, but on the sociopathic tendency side.
So I'm never a big fan of commenting on, you know, executives at big public companies, because there's only so much you pick up about what someone's like from a Twitter or an interview. But we spoke a bunch of times today about Satya at Microsoft. And I think one of the things that makes him so incredible is that he seems to break that mold of the, you know, the sociopath at the top. And if I think about some of the execs that I personally know, and I'll, without naming exactly who, and John, you're probably listening, so you're going to take a laugh. But if I take some execs I've personally known, I've seen, you know, over 20 plus years grow within Microsoft to now, you know, being, you know, reporting line, you know, one or two layers around Satya, it seems that he has been bringing up the good people and pushing out the sociopaths. Do you agree? I mean, I know this is commenting on something that neither of us have deep intimate knowledge of, but you did spend some time at Microsoft, so.
So I think a couple of things that make Satya special are, I do believe that of people who have been able to keep their center, he seems to be one who has been able to do that. Now, I know a lot about his family situation because my family situation are actually incredibly similar, so that we had a couple of brief encounters, but two of them were centered around that, of all things. And I think there's a rootedness that comes with this. I mean, I'm speaking from my own experience, not Satya's in this case here. But there's a rootedness that comes from that, because I don't give a fuck about anything else once if your family situation is in a certain state, with your kids and special needs and all that sort of stuff. It's a weird switch that flips in you. And, you know, again, speaking from personal experience. And I feel like maybe he has a little bit of that or the ability to keep that because of that situation or other things in his life. And maybe it's just who he is too. I do believe that he has probably pushed out the most toxic of the older Microsoft elements, but I also do believe that it's impossible for him to do it fully. And the reason why it's impossible for him to do it fully is because Microsoft is such a large organization, there's multiple layers. There's no matter what, there's still an incentive structure that you've not 100% overhauled. There's that old famous essay, which is the tyranny of the structureless, and Microsoft's pretty structured, but there's still structureless power centers inside all large organizations, and they can be really toxic or really negative. They can be positive too, but they can also be toxic negative, and I think that you can have both inside there. I do believe, though, that one of the things, maybe the most important thing that he did in the most obvious of places with Microsoft was a reorientation on developers at some point, as opposed to SKUs, as opposed to business lines, as opposed to all that sort of stuff. And that may be the most reductionist take possible in the situation, but it also feels directionally correct, which is, for a period of time, it was, no, we got to focus on customer as opposed to Wall Street. And, you know, it kind of worked, right? If that's a story that gets told, who knows? So this is probably, obviously, it's going to be a much more complex story, and there's a lot more that nobody knows from behind closed doors. But yeah, I mean, let's put it a different way. Think about like what we're watching at some other big organizations. Like, why hasn't Oracle ever been able to turn it around? Why hasn't, you know, Google has been doing a decent job in some cases, but it's not the same level of turnaround that Satya saw over Microsoft. And in fact, if anybody was in pole position, it was Google, and somehow Microsoft has effectively leaped them.
Yeah, it's super interesting. I think if we go down that path, we'll spend another hour. You mentioned incentive structures. If an engineering leader listening to this today, you know, is looking around and is recognizing all the sociopathic tendencies that have become part of their organization, to me, it almost sounds that the only way to deal with it is to exit. I can't see an incentive structure change that makes sense within our world. That if you are, of course, if you're at the very top, yes.
Yeah.
But if you're anywhere not at the top, exiting seems like the only way to get away from it.
So I have a rule. I go back to people calling me and all that sort of stuff, right? And I have a rule, which is I don't want a job. I really don't ever really want to go work for a job like that again. However, if everyone were to offer me a job, it has to be, there's one condition that is a non-negotiable. There's a bunch of actually conditions in, on top of this. But one of them would be, there's no role that I would take where I could not affect change across the entire organization. And that might mean firing the entire HR department. That might mean overhauling the entire talent structure. That might mean replacing every single VP in a division or two if I need to. And the reason why that's important is because you can't enter an organization, even as a VP or EVP or whatever the title be, two levels removed from the CEO or one level removed from the CEO with no ability to change some other division. Some other structure. And if you do that, you're basically just going to bang your head against the wall for some period of time. You could collect a large paycheck. You could have a decent 5-year run where there's some aggravation. But if you're after change and you're after growth and you're after like some sort of outcome, that is a rule of mine. And it was the rule when I joined GitHub. I had to own product. I had to own engineering, design, security data, and for basically everything that wasn't finance and sales is what I wanted. And then I built the relationships in those two areas because GitHub was in such need of complete 100% overhaul. And so you had to be able to do that. So you asked a very specific question. If you're not in a position to change that sort of stuff, I don't think that you're going to be successful. You're going to be frustrated. And if your goal is some sort of outcome, you probably do have to exit the business, go on to do something else. However, I do believe if you're in a position to do one of those things, it is possible. And you could even align Machiavellian sociopaths because at the end of the day, they're after power and money. And if they're after on power and money, you change the incentive structure so completely so that they start masking and mimicking to those sorts of things, which is actually really difficult to go do because if you're able to do that, you can be successful. And you can even work with sociopaths because what they're, at the end of the day, you're just basically saying like, you know, I don't want to say pulling strings because that makes you sound like, or me sound like a sociopath, but effectively that's what you're doing too. You're like manipulating some strings and these people are kind of like, all right, great. You're going to give me $10 million if I affect all these outcomes over here, or I'm going to end up as the blah CXO over here. If my entire organization is all kumbaya and we've achieved this and we've hit this goal, blah, blah, blah. Great. I'm going to go do that. And so you can do that. It is just really hard because there's stupid human tricks that come in there and even they will start playing you. They'll start yes-manning you or they'll start praising you in a way that makes you feel good. And you got to I need to make sure my own incentive structure doesn't allow myself to be quote unquote, you know, infiltrated or psyoped by the entire thing that's happening here too. And for senior leaders in small organizations that grow into large organizations, that's the hard part. You actually start to want to insulate yourself from feedback and you start to want to insulate yourself from this and you start to feel good about that sort of stuff. And it actually is very difficult for yourself to stay rooted and understand what's actually happening inside the organization.
I think that's an incredible set of words as advice that we should leave today's episode on. You exit or you change the incentive structure, or you are a sociopath listening to this. But I think that's great, Jason. I think those are some fantastic words for our listeners today. Awesome. I had fun with this one.
This is fun.
Thank you for listening to Developing Leadership. Make sure you subscribe to follow us on our journey to more meaningful engineering leadership. If you have any challenges or topics you would like us to explore in an upcoming episode, tweet or DM us at devleadership_. To learn more about data-enabled engineering and how metrics can help your teams and improve your processes, go to athenian.com. See you in 2 weeks for another episode of Developing Leadership.